Okay.
So, welcome everyone to today's lecture of programming languages. And we will directly pick up where we left off last time. So, we have established our first few steps in implementing object-oriented systems, class-based hierarchies in terms of memory layout by looking at the way that the LVM compiler suite arranges the objects in terms of class class instances in memory and what kind of principles are pursued for that. Particularly, there's this idea of extending a class step by step by each of the components that the child adds to the parent. So then we've had a few first looks into how systems can deal with specifications of class hierarchies where there's more than just one parent for a particular class. And for that, we have looked at two design choices for resolving methods. And there was this idea of having the class hierarchy flattened into just a single sequence of ancestors so that the method resolution order is specified by particularly this sequence, and you can find the appropriate candidate to dispatch to by running through this particular sequence. And for that, there was also several methods which we have covered, which culminated in the C3 linearization concepts. So, with that, we have finished with this linearization of ancestors, and we're now coming back to what we had before, like in the C++ world, where there's multiple inheritance with several parents, and there's no such thing as a linearization of the parents. So what has worked quite well so far was the, having multiple ancestors, arranging them in memory, just putting them in a linearized version of the object's representation. And then we had like static method calls, which would dispatch as usual. The question is now, what do we buy ourselves into when we start adding things like dynamic dispatching together with multiple inheritance? And that's the topic of the next few slides here. So, for the remainder of the talk, we will probably most often see virtual methods. So, that is the keywords that you have for dynamic dispatching in C++. You have to explicitly flag each and every method that you want to dispatch dynamically with the virtual keyword. And as soon as you have flagged a particular method signature as being virtual in your hierarchy somewhere, then every follow-up mentioning of the same signature will implicitly also be virtual. So this is the things that we have to keep in mind for the not so fluently C++ speaking people like me. So we have established that the layout for a thing like the one that we see here, which has two parents A and B, would be to find a sequence in which to put the parents, like here with A followed by B, and we would say that this would be motivated by A occurring in front of B in the inheritance clause. So this would arrange them in that particular way. Also, what we had established in the slides before was the existence of a thing that we called the virtual table, this box over there, which would have entries for all the virtual methods for all the signatures, and you can look up the signature that you, for the signature that you're interested in, what particular implementation there is to be used for dispatching. So let's have a look at how this works together in our case. So for that, we create a new object of type C and then do a cast to object of pointing to something that is typed B, which would be the parent type of C, one of the parent types, so like this one. So this is doing the cast in direction of this, what we call the inner parent. Why inner? Because it's in its representation, it's stored in the middle between the child and the other ancestor. So this is, so that is the inner parent. Now, this is followed by a call to method F on this pointer to the object of type B. And this is, implemented on the intermediate representation side with the following things. So first of all, there is, always depends a little bit on what the compiler generates for you. There are several ways of navigating to the correct entry point of the object. In that case that you see here, we have first a bit cast to type pointer to a byte. For some reason, I don't know why the compiler chooses one over the other, but there's several ways of navigating there. And then doing a navigation step on this pointer to byte by 16 steps, so 16 times a byte. And this is supposed then to end up pointing to this object B's representation within the representation of C. So it circumvents the first 16 bytes, which would be the size of whatever represents A. And then it continues with doing a little bit of casting such that the types are now the ones that we would expect. And then what's done is that this reference is stored to PB. So what we should take away from, what we see from this, this is essentially representing just the first bit of the whole thing, is that when we do casting on such a situation, we actually do a modification of the pointer instead to what we had before, when we had just casts with single inheritance. There was never the necessity of actually really manipulating the pointer that we are keeping for the receiver. Here we do have to, because of this idea of having inner representations of some parents. And in order to reach them and to point to the beginning of the representation, we have to somehow add offsets to addresses in order to reach the right location. So then we will continue with the actual call over here. And this is what is used to translate that thing. So first of all, what you're going to see is that the B pointer is loaded into a particular thing, and then what is done is we do cast to the virtual table. This is what we are supposed to do whenever we have a virtual method call. So there's this convention of that the first entry in the object representation needs to be the virtual table pointer. From there we load the virtual pointer, select the address, in this case by selecting the F entry, which would be just the zeroth method. So this is why we find zero here, and then perform a load and an actual indirect call on that. So a few people have already wrinkled their noses by the sight of what I have done here, and that's maybe because you will say, well, if I look at the position where my pointer goes to and look at what the code is supposed to do, well, one of the first things would have been to cast to the virtual table and load from the address that this is pointing to. And this cast is like the same as assuming that the first entry of the object representation here is actually representing a pointer to the virtual table. So far in our class layout, this hasn't been the case. But in order to keep with the way that code is generated at function calls, in order to still support the same calling scheme, we will have to add another pointer to the virtual table. So instead of just having one virtual table pointer, we will add another virtual table pointer. Why is that? Because there, in our setting with these three classes, we have the possibility that there is that the entry to the object representation cannot only be this part, but also this part. You might now wonder, is there any way that this could be considered a valid pointed to fragment? And the thing is, well, this C thing here is not an actual parent, so you can't really cast up to that thing. Instead, the C representation is already covered by the representation for the complete object in the same manner as it had been for just single inheritance. So the C thing just extends everything that has been formally already done. So whenever I handle my C, I am aware that I have both parents A and B, so I also need to be able to address everything that is in A and B, and thus it makes sense for a C view on the whole object representation to also point not to the part down there, but also to point to the same thing over here. So it doesn't matter whether you have a view of the C object or of a view of the whole object casted to A, both of them go to the very start of our object representation. Only when we look at the object representation of B, we'll have an entry that is a little bit lower. And yeah, this establishes that we only have like two possible starts of object representation, starts of views on my object representation, and only for those two, then, I need pointers to the virtual table. So this is what is added. So there is two pointers to the virtual table now. And also what you might have noticed when looking at these slides here is that I have added a whole lot of new things to the virtual table apart from just pointers from the object representation to the virtual table, and there is a certain reasoning behind that. And well, let's have a closer look at how virtual tables look like. So far, everything that we had established to be found in the virtual table was like a simple list of function pointers that would represent implementations of function signatures that we have marked as virtual somewhere. And it's just a simple list that you can index with an integer. Whatever you have determined for that particular signature, you would look up in there. This would work as long as the object or class hierarchy in that case is a single inheritance-based virtual table. As soon as we start having multiple inheritance, this is a little bit more difficult. And here I have given you a slide that should highlight a few of the contents of the virtual table. So there is a virtual table is now not only just one table anymore, but it may contain subtables. Subtables are things that are occurring in case you have multiple inheritance. So each of them is its own instance of a virtual table. So there is a virtual table, and there is a virtual table in there, so to say. And this one has an entry that starts with, for example, a representation of an f function, and this one also has an f function, but also has a g function for some reason here. There's other components of the whole thing. There is a section that is dedicated to runtime type information, this thing here, but since we are not talking about that particular feature here, this is a thing that I don't want to highlight overly much. Instead, what else is there? There is the last field in there, which is this one, which is the so-called offset to the top of an enclosing memory representation. So if we look back at where we came from, we see that there is two entries of such a thing in play here. So there's one, there's the other one. And these indices or these entries are to be interpreted with respect to the way that you have found to access this virtual table. So if you come to the virtual table from this pointer, you will get pointed to the first entry of the virtual table that is associated with this thing, which would carry this C of F, since this is since we come from A in that view. So by convention, you will find two entries before this CF thing, a number that gives you the offset that the current starting address has to the starting address of the outermost enclosing object representation, which is in our example here exactly the same representation. So therefore, this is as a zero offset. The whole thing changes if we come from a view on the B identity of the whole object. This means that we will enter the virtual table through that pointer, follow this thing to the first entry of the virtual table, and by convention we find two entries above an offset value that will give us the offset of our current representation, meaning this thing with which we entered, to the start of the object representation. So you will find the distance that this B representation has to the start of the object directly in the virtual table. So this is what the offset to top is supposed to mean. And this can be... Yes? So you're talking about this slide here, then?
Right.
So the pointer points to this entry here.
So at that point, you know, like basically how the entry is, so that we can like find the.
Well, here,
offset.
Here you see that the offset is zero, so this doesn't tell you anything about the size of the thing.
For example, for the second case, so if we have the pointer pointing to C,
this
so we can still access the.
So this is not to be confused with the size of the B representation, but with the size of everything that comes before B until the start of the object representation. So this is more like the size of A in our case, but could be even more depending on how many instances there are until we reach the outermost object representation start. So you could, for example, have an object that is composed of, well, let's just assume that this A has other parents, like A inherits from X, X inherits from Y, then they would go like in the beginning, X and Y. So this would mean then that the value here would also would be the size of A, X, and Y. This is usually accessed from the virtual pointer, yes.
And so the runtime, like information entry, has a known size.
So yeah. This one. Yeah, this one has a known size. And it's, in the cases that we have here, it's just one. It's a pointer to some runtime type information table somewhere else. Okay, but yeah, this is just a size of one, so we can always assume that we find this offset to top just at an offset of -2 to the start of the virtual table. Okay, so these things are of course dependent on the context in which a particular class appears. So if the B is standalone without being incorporated into the representation of some C, for example, then this is just the ordinary B virtual table that we had a little bit earlier on. If we have the B as a virtual parent within like this C object representation, then it will be assigned a different virtual table than before by or during the compilation. So the compiler will generate appropriate virtual table versions depending on in which combinations you use certain classes and just prepare them for that particular situation. Of course, if there's several objects of type C, then they will all share the same virtual tables for that are generated for C objects. But there's no arbitrary combinations that are going on. It's just checked whatever is appearing in your program, and for that there is virtual tables that are generated. So the main motivation that you've seen for that is that there is so far that there's two virtual table pointers occurring now in the potentially in your objects. However, you still have not seen the actual situation for which the you would actually need specialized virtual tables. This is going to be on the next slide, but just a short notice beforehand. If you're interested in the actual content of these virtual tables, then I highly recommend this thing here for you, which is the command line for comprehensive overview on the entries of your virtual tables. So if you're ever in need of like debugging what is actually really found where in the memory, then this is the right thing for deciphering the virtual tables. So with that, you can get your own dump of virtual tables in like ASCII art. So why would you need several actual different virtual tables in this setting? So this has once again to do with casting in the context of multiple inheritance. So again, we assume the same or similar situation as before. We have classes A, B, and C, with B already announcing that there is a signature for this F method, and C overriding that in its body, so it still overrides the version from B. So you have now two versions of calling the F later on. So there's this one, which is, well, rather direct. This generates the C object itself and then just calls the method F on C. And since we have overridden the F in the C object, usually the implementation of this F that is called here would assume that it is called with its implicit receiver parameter pointing to an object representation that has a view of type C on the whole thing, which means pointing to the beginning of the actual object. Likewise, you can have a look at what happens in here. So this is now a C object that is created and cast to a B thing. So this B is not C anymore, and now we call that thing here. And by calling convention, since the static type of the receiver is now a B thing, we would call that also with a pointer to B here. However, if both of the entries in the virtual tables would be similar, then both would have to dispatch to this F implementation from C, which would, since it is defined in a C context, would assume that it, the first parameter, this receiver parameter, is of type C in order to access all its attributes. However, this is not the case in that version over here. Calling convention says that you have to cast to B, which is actually not the same entry as B. So the once written method F for C would start to interpret this address that it is given as a C thing and start reading offsets in this pointer that it is given that are meant to be interpreted for a C. It does that on, for example, a B thing, which means that all the offsets are somehow shifted and don't match anymore. So this is a thing that you don't want to have in the situation. So what do you do then? Well, the solution is to not directly link to, or not directly dispatch to, the same functions. Instead, have a specialized entry for the situation that you see over there. So this now is not directly dispatching to the F anymore. However, since this F can be arbitrarily complicated, you would still like to share most of what you have already generated as code for the F in order to not do the same job twice. So what's happening here is that instead of directly calling F, you first call this thing over here, which is a small little helper method that just performs the necessary manipulations to this pointer and then delegates the call over to the original implementation of F for in context of C. And the name for the principle that is used here is so-called thunk. So these thunks are small little so-called trampoline methods that delegate the virtual method to its original implementation, but with an adapted first or this parameter. And in terms of intermediate code, that can look like the following. So this is what is given for the thunk. So in real code that you might decompile from whatever you put into your LLVM code, you will not find that the entry is named the way that I've done it here. This is just for easier reading, so to say. So there is some kind of arbitrary combinations of numbers and characters there, which you first have to disentangle through certain helper calls. But usually you can do that and get out that the method is meant to be thunk for a virtual method call to F. So this is encoded in this scrambly-looking identifier that you'll find in your actual virtual table. And I think the clang or the clang call that I had a little bit earlier already does the disentangling of the names for you, so you don't even have to bother with that. So how does the actual thunk look like? Well, its purpose was to take the first parameter of type pointer to B, since, well, this is what it is given, and somehow make it compatible with whatever this method F would expect, and this would expect the first parameter to be of type pointer to C. So in order to do so, what does it have to perform? Well, it has to, well, in our case, again, it goes this way around by casting to byte pointer and then does a manipulation with just 16 bytes here. And you will, if you have paid attention, you will see, well, the 16 has already occurred once in our examples. This was exactly the amount that the pointer was initially modified in order to point not to the C view on the object representation, but on the B view of the object representation. So this undoes this pointing into the middle to move the pointer back to the beginning of the object, then does the necessary casting in order for the whole thing to become a pointer to C again, and then performs the actual call to the method F here with now a pointer to the C view of the current object. And, well, in our case, returns the result. This could be a thing that could be tail call optimized, of course, but yeah, this is just the unoptimized version of the whole thing. So, yeah, this is what the thunk is all about in this example. So this does compile time computation. Well, not compile time computation. It adds the compile time constant difference that is between the start of the B and the C part to the receiving pointer, and then calls the actual method of choice. And this is what you find then as entries in the virtual tables. So this is like the basic stuff that happens when you combine dynamic dispatching with multiple inheritance. Now let's complicate things a little bit more with modifying our examples to, for example, common ancestors. So you could imagine that you would specify an object hierarchy with C inheriting from A and B, and A and B both would inherit from class L here in that context. And the way that this could be handled is like, well, there's two choices. You could either consider these L's as being like ancestors for A and B separately, or you could think of this L being a shared ancestor for both of them. So, yeah, these are the two possibilities that you have for realizing such a specification. And you might wonder what C++ does in that respect. Well, yeah. The version that is chosen for implementing that by default is this one here. So by default, C++ duplicates common ancestors if you specify it without any other additional things. So the example is now modified so that you have not only C inheriting from A and B, but also B inheriting from L, as well as A inheriting from L. And as I said, if you don't specify anything else, then what will happen is that each of the parents, A and B, will get their own little private L object representation added to their own representation, which will lead to A being represented with this one and B represented being this one, and each of them carries its own representation of L with it. And well, what does that have as consequences? Well, let's have a look at code that deals with that. So for example, there is now a new object of type C created, and you are interested in a pointer to a parent L. Well, in that context now, this is not a unique specification anymore. So in that case here, where we duplicate the parents, we will have two representations of the L object in its memory layout hidden. So this is the cause why that particular statement is ambiguous here. So what you would have to do here in order to make that work again is you would have to add the particular parent whose representation you want to exploit for the actual L here. So you have to add this intermediary cast to B in order to make it unique, whichever L representation you want to reach here. And in this case, this would be this one here. Because you see, there's an actual difference in where you have to cast. So for once, you would have to cast into this one or into the other, and this makes a difference. Then you will be able to translate, for example, such a call. But then there is this other occurrence here, where you would go back to the original surrounding class C, and this is the same case here. Also, you have an ambiguity because depending on whether you start from this L or the other L, you might have to adjust the receiver pointer or not for such a thing. And well, turns out that to make that ambiguous, you would also have to specify how to which way to go by first casting this L to its direct parent B before you can actually do the casting to the C. If you would apply this static casting. So the other case that is out there for common parents is that the idea of like sharing the base class. So in order to specify that in the C++ world, you would have to add another modifier to the inheritance clause, which is another use for the virtual keyword. Yay. And with that, you would specify that A and B would like to share their ancestor. So this creates a little bit of a problem for a memory layout because, well, if you just start with A for itself, it's still easy. If you just lay out A, you just have its parent W, and there's just no debate. You can just place the A under the representation of W and be done with that. But then there's also, where is it? There's also this B being specified with W, and there you can go the same way. You can just lay out them like W and B. The problem is now if you start coupling A and B together as both being parents of C, having specified W as a shared parent with this virtual keyword over here. So this is the thing it would mean that A and B would have to share its parents' representation, which means that there's only one instance of W allowed in the object representation anymore. So, well, this now means that depending on how your implementation would, in principle, choose, either you would arrange it differently to the way that class A arranges its predecessor, or you would arrange the layout differently to what how B would naturally arrange its predecessor. So now we have a situation where a parent's representation is not necessarily found in the same location relative to its child, depending on whether it is used singularly or as parent in a sequence of multiple parents for another class. What that means is, for example, in our thing here is that you have A and B both occurring as parents for C. So, yeah, you could now argue whether you would want to find W represented over here to kind of stress that this is to be seen as a parent of A, but then B is not finding its parent directly in front of. Or, well, you could go the other way around and say you would have to insert a representation for W in between, so you would have to slot it in there, but then you would only carry this W as a parent of B conceptually and not of, as a parent of A anymore. So either way you choose, you lose one kind of association of child-parent relation. So this is a concept that is completely given up as soon as you have virtual inheritance. And instead, what you then find is that whenever you have a virtual base class or virtual parent, in that sense, you will have to navigate your way to its attributes through indirection. And the way that this is implemented is that there is now in the virtual tables for all the methods that are involved in that, a new slot directly above the offset to top, a new slot that would give you the offset from the currently focused object to its virtual base class. So let's do an example. When we first enter the object from here, so we point to, for example, an A view on the object, we would be interested to access an attribute of its virtual parent W, for example, the attribute W. In order to find out where to offset starting from this, from the current pointer, what we would have to do is we can't access it somehow directly with a constant offset from where we point to currently. But instead, what we need to do is we need to query the virtual table, look in there, go back like 1, 2, 3 slots where we find another offset, which gives us a difference from the start of the object down to where we find the representation for the W. Yes?
And why does the virtual table of B have delta W minus delta B, not minus delta W minus delta A?
Yeah, this is to do with, well, I should not have put here the name of, you get it now. So this is like the position of B within the whole thing. So this is not the size of B. But answered? Yeah. So with that, you can navigate your way by adding this delta W to the original entry point into the object and reach this thing in order to access this attribute W. Whereas when you, for example, enter the thing through a pointer to B, which you have created via casting, then you would query this virtual pointer, go to that fragment of the virtual table, and then go back. Oh, sorry, not this one. Go back 3 slots and reach this thing here, which I have kept as an expression, but this is, of course, an actual value in there, which would mean the difference between the position of W and the position of B in the object, which means exactly the difference from here to there. So with that, you just add this value that you find here to your entry into the object and reach your destination W. Okay? So this is what you get for sharing your ancestor. What you also get is that the ancestor might need to somehow reach its children in the context of this thing here, and that is what is done with like this position of with the usual offset to top value here. So with that, you can reach the enclosing object as usually. With that, you also get yourselves into some strange possibilities for errors, like you see here in the side. So the call to F that you see here, which might look like a valid thing to do at first, which will lead you to an error here. So you want to comment on that? I must say I have not understood it all, but you are talking the H thing is the thing that bothers you. So I don't know which entry you mean. I should have put numbers there too.
I didn't realize that the CH is all the way at the top. I'm more than it does.
Yeah, it should be there. Anyway, for the ambiguity thingies, you have a base specification of this F thing, and you would then have this C inheriting from A and B, where A, for example, just overrides this implementation of F. This, in principle, this looks like as if we have provided one updated version for F within the A, which is more recent than the version from W. And thus, you would wonder why the whole thing is ambiguous. The thing is that by incorporating this B thing into your inheritance scheme, you would have created this diamond thing, where this B would treat the original F as its own implementation of F, thus creating a new conflict when the inheritance relation then merges back for C. So in that sense, this overridden F conflicts with its own the overriding F conflicts with the overridden F through this path that goes through B. So this is what can happen, and what you can, for example, resolve by actually directly specifying whatever you want to use here. And yeah, then there is sometimes the necessity for navigating to the virtual base, which we have already said would be done with this offset to the virtual base. So one thing maybe to illustrate a little bit that the location of the common ancestors is actually a thing that cannot be assumed to be a compile time constant. Why is that? Well, this is what I want to show you with this example here. So we have, again, this A, B, C, and W from the slides before. But now we add a new class definition D here, which just inherits from C and B. It doesn't even use any virtual method base, virtual base classes. So the pure existence of this thing, which at first is not really interfering with the first few specifications, means that now you have to not only think about C objects that follow the layout color schemes. I'm sorry. So this specification alone would lead to this memory layout. This is just the layout from the slides before. We have had C with the base classes A and B, and A and B both share its base class W, layouted like this. If you now add another thing that doesn't really alter the specifications from before, you get the layout from here. And this also has a representation that or an internal view of that would be typed with C. But in this thing here now, the difference in object representation between A and its parent W is different from the version from before. Just by having a new specification of a new class a little bit later on. And yeah, no matter which way you would set up your layout principles, whether you would put the W in front or somewhere in the middle, there you can always construct an example that would lead to a situation where you would have different distances between virtual base classes and virtual children. So what you can take away from that is that in shared base classes, there is no There is no guaranteed constant offsets between virtual bases and subclasses anymore. Which means that usually you can't do static casts anymore. Why is that? A static cast like this one here would mean that the compiler would try to add a compile time constant to the original pointer in order to reach a destination. So here, in order to navigate between between the the virtual base and its virtual child, you don't know which way to go, because you would either have to add the distance here or the distance from here to the pointer. In order to still be able to get a similar thing, what you would do is make use of a feature called this dynamic casting, like this dynamic cast instruction, which would actually make use of this offset to top entry in the virtual table. So it would go into the virtual table, look up the offset to top, and then use that in order to navigate the right path. Also, what you should pay in mind is that if casting now involves things that are not constant at a runtime, you will run into a similar problem as we have seen earlier on when we talked about these little buggers that were called thunks. So thunks had the role of undoing manipulations to the receiver pointer. Remember that? And it would do so by undoing this static addition on the receiver pointer by static subtraction on the pointer. This can't be done here anymore, because these navigations between parents and children are now not done with a static offset anymore, but with a dynamic offset. So, what can we do here? Well, instead of this idea of a conventional thunk as we had it before, we will introduce a concept that is called the virtual thunk. They are special purpose tailored for application in virtual base classes. And what means is that in the subsection of the virtual base class of the virtual table, which means this part here, we now get more entries than we had before. So please don't take the thing that you have seen here for the correct one. This was just a temporary draft, so to say. The real virtual table that is used is the one from here. So we get new entries in the virtual table, particularly those ones here. And they are the values that the virtual thunks need for manipulating the receiver pointer to point to the correct object representation. It's absolute rubbish, isn't it? Yeah, but since it's depending on the actual combination between base class and class where the dispatching target is found, you need something like that, because you can't statically determine that otherwise anymore. So, yeah, this is a similar case as the virtual dispatching cache. In terms of the virtual table, this is a cache of the offset manipulations that the virtual thunk needs to do. So, how is it that this works now? Well, we can have a look at one of the virtual thunks given here. So, this is a thunk that is there for matters of preparing a call to G for the for the virtual base W. So this is probably this entry here. So this is then dispatching instead of directly to G or to the ordinary thunk. This is dispatching to this virtual thunk thing now, whose job it is to, in the end, of course, call the original G, but with a modified this pointer, so they are meant to be somehow manipulated. And so the we have to find our way from whatever we get given here to this thing here. I don't know why it is considered to be of class B pointer. This should in principle be a W, but I think the compiler at some point really gave up about typing. in principle, this is the thing that you get for this cast here, and this is a pointer to the W thing. So don't give a whole lot about the typing that is in there. This is in principle just considered to be an address which is not pointing to the correct item here. And we already see, if you look a little bit deeper, that we will, the first thing that we will do is we will reinterpret the whole thing as just a pointer to bytes. And then what is done is, well, we will have a look at the virtual table and load the pointer to the virtual table into a reference element here. And then what you see is that with this will go like along here, pointing into that thing here. From there, now we need to find our way to these helper constants here that will encode the difference between the W view on the object to the to the B view on the object. And to do so, what is done is we navigate from where we have pointed to back 32 bytes, which is like the what is it? Though, let me just so this is meant to reach that part here, so you might wonder, from where do we know this number that we have to navigate back? Well, this is like we have well-known sizes that are used for this RTTY and the offset at the top. These are like two slots in the memory. And then we have here the start of all this, these correcting offsets, and they are arranged in with the same indexing as the entries to the in the virtual table that are used down there. So if we have index 0, 1, and 2 here, we can also go 0, minus 1, minus 2 into that direction. So if you take the negative values of the index that has been used as the entry here, we reach to the we reach the offset that we are desiring, that is to be used for that particular virtual thunk. So in our case, we have to go back two slots because we are using the method from this slot down there. And yeah, this gives us this minus 32. And then what is done is this is loaded. So this is the so-called vcall offset, which is loaded from the virtual table. And this then is used in order to manipulate the entry pointer, this receiver pointer. So this is used together with the with the offset to top in order to come up with the actual entry address of B's view on the object, and then is given to the call to the actual method G. So for the virtual tables now, for virtual bases are the way that you see here. So virtual tables for a virtual subclass will have a slot for for the offset that reaches the virtual base, and the subtables that are there for virtual bases have a region where they store virtual call offsets. They have a slot for the offset to top and the actual virtual function pointers that are possibly virtual thunks, depending on, well, they are usually virtual thunks, a little bit depending on where the implementation, the concrete implementation that is supposed to be dispatched to comes from, but usually you will find a virtual virtual thunk there if it is if this is a method that is overridden somewhere deeper in your class hierarchy. But I think there's a tutorial that should help you in deepening that a little bit later on. So, all in all, for the for multiple inheritance and virtual dispatching, this is quite an intricate example of collaboration between compile time and runtime. So here is like an overview on what is handled by which phase. So the compiler usually creates for each method just one chunk of code, and this is supposed to be used wherever possible, and you don't want to specialize that code right on. So that's just one implementation of that. In case you need something a little bit more for different purposes, you will put these trampoline methods into the code. The compiler also generates one virtual table for each composition of classes. It does that once and puts it in the read-only section of your binary, such that it can be loaded into memory at runtime and pointed to by each of the object instances that are created throughout your program. You might have subsections of the tables if you have composed your classes out of several parents, for example, and then you will get these structures of virtual tables instead of just one plain virtual table. And yeah, those are also just existing in the same space there, so there are therefore all objects of that particular type. You might find offsets that are meant to be used on top of the entry pointer to the object representation, such as the top of the object or virtual base offsets. So these are ones that might differ from table instance to table instance, depending a little bit on the context in which they are used. And the entries that you find in virtual tables are, in the simplest of all cases, just direct function calls to a particular implementation. In the more complex versions, it's thunks or virtual thunks that do computations on the receiver parameter in order to reestablish the calling convention such that indexed access to attributes of a particular object still work the way that they should. The parts that are taken over by runtime is that, well, the program at startup creates those virtual tables once globally by copying them from the binary into some well-known space in memory. And during object creation, then you do the allocation of the memory space first, and then the constructor calls, which will then store pointers to these well-known virtual table locations within the objects. And later on, you can just do use the same method calls, since they comply to this idea of how your conventions for methods calls are. They are they don't need to be made aware of the real class identity, but instead you just default to having the if it is a virtual method call, you just consider the first entry in the object representation as being a virtual table, and everything from there on will be handled and prepared accordingly by the actual compile time phase, such that you will eventually reach the right destination. So that is that. So yeah, well, there's a few consequences that you get whichever path you take, whether you do full multiple inheritance or whether you just restrict your language to be able to inherit from several interfaces. And yeah, well, this is a very there's no right or wrong here. This is just different ideas of how you want to program here. So it's not for me to judge these kind of things. But there's a few differences in there. So for this full multiple inheritance with not just interfaces but actual real implementations, you kind of, well, remove one of the constraints that are otherwise there on inheritance. This makes it a life maybe a little bit easier and more convenient in a few cases. We have talked a lot now about strange concepts like sharing the same... sharing the same ancestor at some point and having overlapping namespaces for their methods or attributes and all that. And well, these cases exist, but they in practice maybe don't use up as much space as they have done for the slides here. So they exist, but you don't necessarily run into these kinds of problems in that sense. In terms of restricting yourself to just multiple interface inheritance, this is a thing that can be very simply implemented. You just can take away a whole lot of the complete part of the lecture here if you just restrict yourself to interface inheritance, because you will never have things like multiple parents, thus you never nest object identities into others, class instances into others, so you will never have to manipulate this pointer in any way, and you don't get any actual semantics from a cast instead of just a skip. You do never have to manipulate your pointers, so you never have to undo these things. You can get rid of all these concepts like thunks and all that. You don't need any vcall offset entries into virtual tables or anything. So this makes life a lot easier in terms of implementation of your object layout and runtime of the whole thing. And usually with these interface inheritance things, you can already express quite a lot of things. And yeah, depending on which people you're listening to, there's a lot of them that preach that having a lot of full multiple inheritance in your object design or class designs, is considered to be a flaw anyway. So, that's not for me to judge in that sense. So, what you've seen in this part of the lecture here is, different purposes of inheritance, like this implementation inheritance versus interface inheritance. You have seen layouts for objects in C++, particularly in the LVM and GCC. You have seen how virtual tables are layouted and help in resolving the expressions to dispatch targets. You have seen how the LVM represents code to access and represent objects in general. You've seen concepts about linearization of object hierarchies and, well, the actual consequences, what you buy yourself into as soon as you use multiple inheritance with full-fledged virtual tables with all these different offsets and entries in there, and yeah, take away from that what you want. A few side notes maybe for people who try to find the concepts that we have had in this lesson in Microsoft's implementation of C++. So this is a little bit different than the version from GCC or LVM. So the approach from Microsoft distributes the information a little bit differently than the GCC and LVM does. So the virtual tables are, well, in the virtual C++ world, split a little bit more than you see here. And the virtual base pointer, for example, is kept in the object representation instead of in the virtual table. So, yeah, there's a few small differences there, but largely you can find similar concepts in the object layout than you have in the GCC world. So there's a lot of references that you might want to be interested in. But I guess the most interesting thing for a few of you will be like the mini-seminar topics, which I will show you.